from Santa Cruz, California. I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. One of the most joyful and soulful hit makers of the 1970s, Tony Tennille is my guest. Tony Tennille is a Grammy winner, a television star, an accomplished songwriter and stage performer, and now an author. Her book, Tony Tennille, a Memoir, is one of the best autobiographies I've read. Tony Tennille, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Well, my gosh, thank you so much, Gary. Wow, I love the author thing. That was
oh, that's you.
That's pretty exciting to have author in front of my name. Of course, I have to give half the credit to Caroline Tennille St. Clair, my niece.
Yeah.
She did a great job.
Well, how did she work with you? How did that partnership happen?
Well, I was not intending to write a memoir at all. I had spent the last 8 years in Prescott, Arizona, trying to figure out what I was going to do about my marriage to Daryl. And I kept my head way down below the radar during that time. But once I had finally made the decision to divorce Daryl, I knew that I finally had sort of an end or the end of the next beginning to what could be a book. But I would never have written it by myself because I can tell what happened. I'm really good at saying, when we were at the White House, this happened. I can write all that out. But when Caroline gets it, I would send it to her. Oh, by the way, she agreed to write with me because I wouldn't have written it with anybody else, honestly, just Caroline. But when she would take what I sent to her, that was what I wrote, and then she would enhance it so the reader could feel like they were actually there. It's kind of a magical thing that she did. And then she would send it back to me, and I'd go over it and read it out loud and, you know, read it over and read it out loud to make sure it was exactly the way I would say things. And that's how we managed to work it out. It took us 2 years to write it. So we were, you know, careful about all sorts of things. But it was fun, too.
Well, speaking of being careful, Tony Tennille, your memoir, it tells us a lot of personal stuff that we never knew. And so now that it's, you know, it's out there and you're out here talking about your book, you know, is it uncomfortable? Do you have second thoughts about being so revealing?
No, I really don't. Because I needed to write this book to explain to all of the fans that we've had for years and years and years. That was one of the reasons I waited so long to make that decision, is because I knew how really, really disappointed and upset some of them would be. And I wanted them to understand my thinking, why I came to this decision. It wasn't something I just did lightly. I thought about it for years and years and years before I made the decision. And I thought maybe if they read the book or my story, they would understand why I did what I did. So that was a major reason for writing the book.
Well, there's so much in the book. I mean, it's not just recent events. It's your whole lifetime.
No.
And one of the things that really I was really enjoying is the fact that you, and this is one of the great things about your story, you were 35 years old before you became famous. So you had this whole life, you know, before becoming famous. What was that like for you to suddenly become famous?
Really frightening. Really, really scary. Because Daryl and I had been, you know, we'd been working in dumps and clubs and everything like that, just trying to make some money so we could get by. And when, you know, we finally had our choice of a few record companies, because we went to the Smokehouse, which was the last place we worked, and that was a really good place for us to build up a huge following. But when Love Will Keep Us Together, it's a long story that Love Will Keep Us Together, but when that finally hit, as big as it did, I wasn't really ready for what came after. It was okay at first because, you know, a lot of people had not seen us very often because, you know, we'd done a little, you know, Dick Clark show here, Dinah Shore there, show there, but not constantly in people's face all the time. So people didn't really know us that well, but the minute we did the television show, all that was over. And the thing that was hard for me is the reason I did it was because of the music, because I loved the music. I loved working with Daryl on the music. Of course, obviously, if you read the book and you know nothing much else happened, but that was where we really, really connected. And so when you have a big hit record like that in a television show, fame comes with it. It just comes, whether you're ready for it or not. And the thing that I thought of, well, I'm thinking of today, now that I've popped my head back up after 8 years with this memoir, we didn't have social media. We didn't have anything like that. And when I first started ready to release the book, I really was nervous. Because, first of all, I didn't know anything about Twitter and Snapchat and all that stuff, but my niece does. Mm-hmm. And she really, really helped me through all this social media stuff. And, you know, Facebook and professional page instead of my little private page with my Australian Shepherd friends and stuff like that. So, and Daryl, it was never as hard for Daryl at first because he never went anywhere. I was used to being able to go out and go around, do some shopping, sit down with my book and have lunch and just not, you know, just in, sort of enjoy it. But that sort of all ended, you know, once the television show happened in particular. It was hard.
Well, it's been a lot of years since the Captain mm-hmm. and Tennille were active. Mm-hmm. So what about now? Can you walk down the street and nobody bothers you now?
You know, kind of. I'll tell you the story. When I was living in Prescott, I worked with my Australian Shepherd, Smokey, as a therapy team at the hospital. He and I worked there for 6 years together.
Wow.
And when I first moved to Prescott, we visit patients and their families and hospital staff. When I would go into a patient's room or when I would meet their families, nobody would recognize me. They would look straight at the dog. He was a beautiful dog, and he was a sweet dog, and that's what it's supposed to be. I would say about 1 out of 8 people would look up at my name tag and say, oh, are you Tony Tennille? But then the local paper did a couple of stories about me and Smokey working there together. And then once people realized I was living there, we were living there in Prescott, I became noticed more often. And like today, I just got back from the big thing we did in L.A., 5 days of media insanity, and I went out and had to go to the market, so I just took my hair and put it in 2 pigtails, one on each side, or ponytails, and no makeup and old ratty clothes, and went to the market, and nobody noticed me, which was really nice.
That
I
was
can
good.
Still do that. Yeah.
So you're not like Norma Desmond waiting for the spotlight to come back on you?
Oh, yes, I'm ready for my close-up, Mr. DeMille. No. No. Not at all.
Well, while I was reading your book, Tony mm-hmm. Tennille, a memoir, naturally I had to listen to your albums and watch your TV shows on the DVD.
Yeah.
And I was watching, I think it was your first show, and you were singing Someone to Watch Over Me.
Yeah.
And you sing it so beautifully. And it's not at all the kind of song, I think, that I was thinking that that's a Tony Tennille song. And your voice is beautiful, and maybe not the voice that I associated with you. If I closed my eyes, I saw a different uh-huh. kind of person. What are the singers that influenced you?
Well, you know, my daddy was a big band singer in the late 1930s. He sang with Bob Crosby and his Bobcats, and he was a beautiful singer. He had a lovely voice. He had to leave show business and go take over the family furniture store when his father died, when he was in his mid-20s. and he couldn't continue with his career. But he raised me and my sister Jane, and then Louisa when she got old enough, to on the great music of the 30s, 40s, early 50s. And he would come home every single day with some kind of an album for us to listen to, and we'd go out in the room where the hi-fi was, and he'd say, "Now listen to this, wait till you hear this." And it would be Sarah Vaughan, it'd be Ella Fitzgerald, it would be Count Basie, it would be Woody Herman, it would be something like that. And that was my education, and that's where I came to love that music so much. When Daryl and I sang with a big band when I was at Auburn University, and that was the kind of music we sang. Was, you know, the Great American Songbook, it's called today.
Mm-hmm.
But when Daryl and I got together and we're trying to figure out what we were going to do as far as music, he said, "Well, I don't do jazz." And I said, "Well, okay, we'll do something else." So we compromised, and that, you know, he was a boogie guy. That was his favorite thing. We were both classically trained. We both had 10 years of classical piano, but he was a Fats Domino, Jerry Lee Lewis kind of a guy. So we ended up kind of with Captain and Tennille, but someone to watch over me was arranged for me by the great, dear Sammy Nestico, who is now 92 and still arranging, and he did my entire symphony book and my big band book for me when I started singing with symphonies and big bands, that music that you're not familiar with my voice doing.
Well, that made me think. I mean, I know that, you know, meeting Daryl Dragon was, you know, crucial in starting your recording career.
Yes.
But do you feel, when you look back in your book, did he hold you back also as a performer in some ways?
No, because I never would have been able to do the other things I did if he and I had not had the music that we did. And I will tell you, he was my muse. He was what inspired me. I knew I could, well, a lot of the songs I wrote were about my longing for him, my longing for his love, of which he was just not able to express or give. And it's not his fault, it's my fault, because I thought I could, you know, bring him out into this wonderful joy that I've always experienced with music and with life and all of that, and I just never could. But I know that I was his muse as well. We sparked each other in that way. One of the ways I knew I could win his approval was because I knew he thought I was a great singer and a really fine songwriter and musician. And that was, you know, kind of what carried me through most of the, you know, the years, the decades we were together before I started realizing I was going to have to find my own way.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf. We're talking with Toni Tennille, and her new memoir is called Toni Tennille, a Memoir. On the Captain and Tennille show, there are a lot of jokes about the eccentricity of the captain, your husband,
mm-hmm.
Daryl Dragon.
Mm-hmm.
And those jokes were more rooted in reality than anybody watching the show would have dreamed.
Well, Daryl was exactly what he was. When people saw him on television, they thought it was an act. It wasn't. That's just the way he was. He had a kind of a strange sense of humor. He couldn't be scripted. He was really uncomfortable. Well, he'd never had an experience in front of audiences. I had all my life, beginning with my mother with her talk show in Alabama in the 50s when I was growing up. You know, I was watched her do her TV show and learned about television from her. And then I always did theater. I was always involved in acting in some form. I was comfortable with audiences. Daryl was not. He always wanted to be the guy in the back playing the keyboards. And, in fact, when he worked with his brothers in clubs around Malibu and around in there, his brother Doug sang lead, and Daryl was always in the background. So when he and I got together, he knew that I could cover that for him. I could be the person who, you know, who talked to the audience and introduced the songs and, you know, kept the show going. But when we agreed to do the television show, he couldn't do that. He had to be right up front with me. And he was very, very uncomfortable always. And the kind of awkwardness that he expressed was real. There was nothing fake about Daryl on that show.
So you would like to have continued doing the Captain and Tennille show longer?
I liked it. I loved it because although it was you know difficult, it was hard, but I loved it because of the challenge and of all the wonderful, great artists I got to sing with and do skits with and things like that. But he was pretty adamant. We tried to quit halfway through. I mean, he said, I can't do it anymore. So we went to Fred Silverman, who was vice president of entertainment for ABC at the time. He was the one who signed us. And we said, Daryl said, I can't do this anymore. And he said, well, I wish you would rethink that, because there were only three networks then, you know, ABC, NBC, and CBS. And we were getting 34 million viewers every single week.
Isn't that incredible?
We were up against Rhoda and Little House on the Prairie, and we all split the pie at that time. But still, you know, that was really successful. So Fred suggested a few more producers that maybe we might like to have, and he gave us the name of Dick Clark for one of them, and Daryl and I went, that's the one we want, and Daryl agreed to continue and finish the first season with Dick. Because he could be kind of the bridge between the younger artists, the top 40 artists, the people we could get on the show, and their parents. You know, he was always that anyway when he had his show on his dance show.
American Bandstand,
right. So, and he really got Daryl, and he did his best to try to make Daryl comfortable. Daryl was terrible with scripts. And the skits he needed to do, he was uncomfortable with. But if you could let him do some kind of an almost improvisational thing where he could go off into some weird thing, like Jonathan Winters, who was one of his idols, if he could do that, then he was much more comfortable. So Dick brought in a wonderful comic, John Biner. And he and Daryl would practice the skit pretty much as it was laid out. And the minute the cameras were rolling, they were off in some other world. And it was, it was just hysterically funny, although I didn't understand what they were doing, but it was so absurd. It was so absurd, it was funny. And Daryl liked that. But overall, at the end of the season, he said, I just don't want to do it anymore. So we agreed to do three specials for ABC, and that was it. We did one a year, and that was the end of our television thing.
On one of your specials, I saw you singing with Ella Fitzgerald. That must have been incredible.
Oh, when you're talking about who my influences are?
Yeah.
Well, I had many, and not all of them were women, but Ella was number one. Sarah Vaughan, a great jazz singer named Carmen McRae.
Sure.
Peggy Lee. June Christie, Chris Connor, I loved all of them. Edie Gourmet was a great jazz singer, and nobody knew it because, you know, they wanted her to sing basically the pop that she was doing.
Well, blame it on the bossa nova.
One of her favorite songs. I mean, she was a brilliant, brilliant singer. She just blew me away all the time.
Hmm.
But then, of course, Frank Sinatra, no doubt about it, and then also the great, great blues singer, Joe Williams, who was always elegant and classy and just knocked my socks off every time I heard him sing.
Your songs on the TV show were more rhythm and blues kind of oriented than on your records. Would you say that's true?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it would. And I loved singing those songs. I mean, we did Shop Around. That was one of our hits.
Right. Uh-huh.
The Smokey Robinson tune. I'm a kind of a versatile singer. I can do a lot of stuff. And I got a big kick out of doing those songs. And one of the albums we did for Casablanca, we called Make Your Move, and that was from a tune that B.B. King sang called Never Make Your Move Too Soon. And that was a flat-out, down-out blues tune, and funky blues, and I just had a ball doing that song. It just, you know, it depended. Then I could turn around and do Muskrat Love, you know. It just, whatever, it was all fun. I could even sing some country, but that wasn't my genre, you know.
Well, Tony, Neil, speaking of your versatility, can you autograph my Pink Floyd, The Wall album?
You bet. You bet. You know, that was so funny because, you know, Bruce Johnston and Carl Wilson, who was the middle of the Wilson brothers of the Beach Boys, and I and a studio singer named John Joyce, whenever we were all in town if one of our colleagues needed some backgrounds, we would go in and do it for them. I mean, we did some for Elton John. We did some for Art Garfunkel, for example. And then one day Bruce called me and he said, Tony, Pink Floyd's in town. And they need some backgrounds, you know, done. Are you game? And I said, yeah, I'm on. I'd love to do it. And honestly, I really didn't. I mean, Gary, I knew their name and I knew they were a rock group. but that's really about all I knew. But I, you know, me, I like all kinds of music. And I thought, well, this will be really interesting. I'd love to see how a rock group does a session. And we went to a place in L.A. called the, I'll never forget, it was a Sunday morning. And we went to Producer's Workshop was the name of the studio where they were working. And we walked into the studio. Daryl went with me because he wanted to see how they handled it, too. And I don't know, you know, I expected, you know, groupies, you know, Rob Dope, the stuff like that. I thought that's what it would be. But Dave Gilmore met us right at the door, and he said, oh, I'm so glad to see you. He said, I just saw you on television this morning. And I said, what were you watching on Sunday morning? And he laughed, and he said, well, I was watching Kids Are People, Too, with my kids. And that was a little kid show that Daryl and I had guessed it on. So there goes the whole rock thing, you know, the image. And it was one of the most professional sessions I have ever seen in my life. Not a groupie in sight, no drugs that I could see. They knew exactly what they wanted. They knew exactly what to ask for. And it was just beautifully done. And then, of course, a few months later, when they got ready to go out and tour with The Wall, Dave called me and said, listen, I've got tickets for you. You want to come to the show? And I said, well, yeah, of course I do. And then he said, let me ask you one more thing. He said, I'll make sure you've got tickets. He said, would you be interested in going out and doing backgrounds with us on this tour? Oh, my God. Would I? Oh, yeah, but I couldn't. You know, I couldn't. We were still doing Captain and Tennille, and I knew I couldn't go out and do that. That would have been really a fabulous experience. They went all around the world on that thing.
Yeah.
And I saw it. I mean, what a... Did you see it? Did you see The Wall?
I did. That's. I saw their tour when they did Animals, but I didn't see them do The Wall.
Oh, my God. It was one of the most brilliant things I have ever seen in my life. It was in the sports arena in L.A., this huge building, and I thought, oh, how are they ever going to have decent sound? Quadraphonic sound. It was all around you. It was perfection. The lighting, everything, the concept. It was just, I was just totally in awe. Totally in awe. And that was an experience I'll never forget.
And some kid came up to you and said, what are you doing here?
Right. When I went with Bruce Johnston's wife because Daryl didn't want to go. So we were taking our seats, and this he was probably 15, you know, 14, 15, maybe 16. And he recognized me, and he, with great disdain, said, what are you doing here? And I looked at her, and she looked at me, and I said, well, I'm here as a special guest of Dave Gilmore and Roger Waters. I sang on The Wall, backgrounds on The Wall. And he said, you didn't. I said, yes, I did. My name is on the album. And he said, well, my friend has one. I'm going to go check. So he left. He came back a little while later, and he said, can I have your autograph? All of a sudden, I loved it because all of a sudden I was cool.
That's right. He wasn't impressed that you sang with Ella Fitzgerald. He was only impressed
no,
that you sang
not
with...
in the least. Not in the least. But The Wall, oh, yeah.
Well, Tony Tennille, what about Daryl Dragon? Has he read your book? Has he reacted to your book at all?
You know, the last time I called him, when Caroline and I were in New York about three weeks ago doing promo, and on the way back, I called him from the car headed out to the airport, and I check on him. We talk about at least every week or 10 days, and I said, how are you doing? And he said, I saw your interview on the Today Show today. And Caroline was sitting there with me, and she could hear because, you know, she could hear what he was saying. And I said, well, what did you think? And he said, I was proud of you, which absolutely blew me away. It's the most positive thing he's ever said to me about me since I've known him. and he is indeed. And he seems to be really thrilled with the interest in our music, that is, you know, the resurgence of interest in the music that we did back in those days. And his health is much better. He did find out that he does not have Parkinson's. He has a tremor that is exacerbated by his anxiety about it.
Is he disappointed then that he doesn't have Parkinson's?
Well, you know, that's so funny that you would say that. Because, oh God, you really got him, didn't you, Gary? Because when he was positive, no matter what the doctor said, that he had it, he just said, okay, I give up. That's it. Took to his bed and just was, I'm there, I'm waiting until it's all over. And of course, now he knows that he doesn't have it. And when I talked to him a little while ago, I said, you know, Jane and I, my sister Jane, we're going out to Prescott to see all our old friends and sign some of their books while we're there. And that's where Daryl lives. And I said, would you like me and Jane to come by while we're there? And he said, yeah, I would. And he said, I'm working on my physical therapy. He said, I should be walking again by then. And that's when I knew he's starting to take command of his own life, which is just a joyous to me.
So divorce has been good for your relationship?
It has. And you know, the thing is, he still has a great business mind as far as our career. It was his idea when we first started that we would never sign with a publishing company. We would have our own publishing company, and we would hire a company to administer it, but it was going to be ours, so that all the publishing money went to us, as well as the writers on the things that we wrote. And I still defer to him on matters of you know, business decisions like that.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf, and we're talking with Grammy Award-winning singer, songwriter, actress, author, Tony Tennille. Well, I love a lot of the records that you wrote, a lot, but of course, Love Will Keep Us Together is the song that everybody will always know you the best.
Oh, of course. And that was the first one, right out of the box, you know.
And in your book, you mm-hmm. talk about that recording session with the Wrecking Crew. Can you sort of take us into A&M Studios for a minute?
Oh, sure. Well, we had pretty much finished our first album for A&M, but we needed one more. We thought we needed one more song, and it was kind of ballad heavy, and we thought we could use an up-tempo. And up to that time, of course, Hal Blaine, the great drummer of the Wrecking Crew, had been working with us. And what I didn't know until later was that Hal had gone through a really tough time. The Wrecking Crew wasn't getting the work. I mean, he was part of that famous group. But he himself was pretty much down on his, didn't have a lot of money, and he wasn't getting the calls anymore. I didn't know that, and Daryl and I hired him just being thrilled that he was going to play on our album, because he played, oh my God, the number of hit records from the 60s, 50s, 60s on that he played on was amazing. But anyway, so to get back to Love Will Keep Us Together, so we found the song, an A&R guy there at A&M, Kip Cohen, actually played us Neil Sedaka's album, Sedaka Is Back, that he released only in UK, because he was having a downtime in his career. He couldn't get arrested in the United States other than as a songwriter, but not as a singer. And he went to England because he knew they liked him there, and he released that album, and Kip played it for us, and we heard Love Will Keep Us Together and went, oh, that's it. That's the song we're looking for. There was no doubt about it. And we went right in the studio the next day, and within 3 days, with Hal Blaine on drums and Daryl playing most of the keyboards and me and my sister singing backup, we had that single done. And we knew when we played it back that it was really good, that it had a shot. It was hooky and it was fun, and Daryl had the gift of being able to produce records that would just pop out of the radio, especially on AM, which was so popular then. you know, if you're changing stations and you heard like two bars, you'd have to stop and listen to it. And it just depended on what radio was looking for at that time. And it happened that they were ballad heavy and wanted an up-tempo. And that was how Love Will Keep Us Together was. We stepped in through that door when it opened at just the right time with just the right song. And so much of it was luck. And that's the way the business is, really.
And that song and that record was Record of the Year. And it, you know, it truly was the Record of the Year. I mean, when you hear that record, it's 1975 all over again.
Well, you know, it's really interesting, Gary. People, you know, now that you know we've been out there and we've been promoting the book, I am getting so many messages from people on my Facebook page and comments who go into great detail about songs of ours that were part of their lives, part of the memories that will always be there. Just like for me, it's Ella, and it's Sarah Vaughan, and it's all the great big bands, and that those are mine. And of course, it was the Coasters and the Platters and all that stuff that was going on in the 50s too with pop music. But I can go right back where I was when I hear or sing those songs, and these people do the same thing. And to think of that, I told Daryl, I said, you've got to get on that Facebook page of mine, which is The Real Tony Tennille, by the way, because there is a Tony Tennille on it, isn't me. So I had to use The Real Tony Tennille. I said, you got to go on there and read these comments, Daryl, because you have no idea how much your music meant to so many people. And I think he's just loved reading that. And I think he's just kind of realizing that. He's just a different man, you know? He's just kind of a different man. But I'm seeing a change, and I'm glad it's happening before it's too late, if you know what I mean.
Oh, absolutely. Well, this book is such a wonderful book, and I want everybody to read it. It's called Tony Tennille, A Memoir. And it's been a real honor having you on From the Bookshelf, Tony Tennille. I hope you'll come back and talk to us again.
I will do that anytime you like. And I will tell you that Caroline and I were just talking last night. We're home back in Lake Mary, Florida now. About a children's book that we're thinking of writing about Smokey, my dog that I worked with at the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a kid's book, Smokey the Therapy Dog, and I'll be writing some songs for kids on that. So that's probably going to be our next project.
Well, I
so
hope
maybe
you
we'll talk to you then.
I hope so.
All right, Gary, thank you so much for having me on.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the show, and we'll come back to FromTheBookshelf.com next week and listen to another show. You can like us on Facebook, and you can subscribe to our podcast at iTunes. I want to thank my guest, Tony Tennille. Her book is called Tony Tennille, A Memoir, written with her niece, Caroline Tennille St. Clair. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening. See you next time.